This is the London FinTech Podcast, bringing you practical insights and approaches, stories and inspiration from the innovators who are building the new world of financial services. Welcome to the London FinTech Podcast. Today's discussion is going to be a bit of a head spin, at least it is for me. Whilst we've all been pedaling at Mach 3 to navigate the AI revolution and the now rapid rise of institutional blockchain and crypto solutions, there is another innovation that's been in the background for several decades with serious implications for the world of finance. I'm talking about quantum computing. Quantum means, to me at least, large, super-cooled machines, mind-bending physics, a promise of super-powerful computation. The concept was proposed in the 90s and the first rudimentary machines in the late 90s. But more recently, the research has reached the stage that major institutions are starting to look at the practical implications for asset security, custody, and valuation, particularly. I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Jensen, Head of Crypto Research at Franklin Templeton. Listeners will recognise Franklin Templeton as one of the largest and most innovative investment firms on the street, I think currently around $1.7 trillion under management. And Chris has recently written a paper on digital asset security in the quantum era. So he's here to help us understand what quantum computing is all about and how it's likely to impact on the crypto landscape going forward. I have to say, I find the physics fascinating. However, it's a complicated topic, so I hope Chris is going to be patient with me on this one. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks. A pleasure to be here, Tony.
It's good to see you. So how's your week gone so far?
So far, so good, despite volatility in the markets. But yeah, other than that, holding up pretty well.
Yeah, head of crypto research. And I think I had a quick look at it. Bitcoin's way down. I don't know how much of that is to do with quantum risk, which we're going to be talking about in a minute, or whether it's all the other things that are going on.
That is a question that's out there. I think we've seen a divergence between, say, you know, Bitcoin as this form of digital gold and actual physical gold. And so a lot of market participants have been wondering why the divergence. And so there's certainly a camp out there that is pointing their finger at the increased attention that quantum computing as a risk for Bitcoin and digital assets. They're pointing to that as an explanation for why there's that disconnect. We think it's, not to cut to the chase, but we think there's certainly some overhang from that, but we think there's a lot going on here, and there's plenty of other macro reasons and whatnot for the current price action.
Yeah. Well, we'll dig into the quantum risk part of that in a few minutes, but just before we do, where are you based? Where are you speaking from today?
Sure. I'm dialing in from Ann Arbor, Michigan, you know, here in the States. I kind of grew up on both coasts, the West Coast and the East Coast, but I've been here in the Midwest since 2021.
Yeah. And how did you end up heading up crypto research at Franklin?
So I've been at the firm a little over 10 years and been on the buy side, you know, principal investing in various alternatives for about 20 years. And generally, most of my background is actually on the private credit side of things and, you know, looking at especially finance businesses. And then it was tech enabled, you know, finance businesses. And so, you know, we started to kind of build this reputation at really the intersection of finance and technology. I think if you would kind of extend that out, you quickly go from fintech over to crypto and digital assets. And so I've been kind of full-time in the crypto space probably since 2018, 19, and personally got involved, you know, a couple of years before that.
Yeah, I think that intersection of finance and technology is probably where all firms find themselves, certainly sooner rather than later. But in Franklin's case, you're right on the leading edge. And I know you're doing lots of sort of trusted node stuff on various networks and you've tokenized your funds. In fact, I had a great conversation with Sandy Call on this podcast a few months back about the next 50 years of the finance industry, essentially, on blockchain rails. So you guys are right up the front there.
Yeah, she's the greatest, in my opinion. And so we were super happy when she joined us and now, you know, kind of leads innovation efforts for the firm. And, you know, I think what's interesting about our story, and I'm sure she went into it, so I won't belabor it, but just to underscore it, you know, I think we really set out the platform as, hey, we want to not just invest in this space because we recognize this is an emerging asset class, but we want to actually use the technology, right, to transform and disrupt our own business. Oh, is it an opportunity or a threat? We decided to just embrace it wholeheartedly. And so, you know, we're builders on blockchain, we're customers of blockchain. So I think that's super helpful because I sit squarely on the investment side. So for me to have in-house blockchain engineers that I can call to kind of ask more technical questions, or we even have, you know, an in-house really savvy quantum expert. And so, you know, I can do a diligence call in-house with that person as well. It's just tremendous resources that help the investment team, you know, really kind of do our job.
And that industry transition only seems to be accelerating. There's a major headline almost every day around stable coins or some crypto related deal. But before we dive into all of this, when you're not crypto researching, Franklin, what do you like to do when you're off duty, Chris?
Yeah, sure. So I've always loved, you know, hobbies on the kind of fitness side. You know, I enjoy, you know, CrossFit and kind of mountain climbing and that sort of thing. But I also like to dabble in cooking, particularly outdoor, you know, kind of barbecue, grilling, smoking, that sort of thing, and a variety of kind of global cuisines.
I don't know whether you've combined those and barbecued at the top of a, you know, a big mountain or something.
Not yet, but that would be fun.
Yeah. Okay. Something to work forward to. All right. So let's, with, you know, the research I did for this episode, as I was saying to you before we hit record, was sort of giving me a bit of a neck ache from the head spin. The more you dive into, I think you called it a rabbit hole, the more you get drawn in. You know, and for those who have maybe taken a look, and there'll be people listening to this who know a lot more about quantum than I do, but I picked up on a few things. So the 2025 Nobel Physics Prize was for really proof of quantum tunneling, which is a thing where quantum particles can find their way to what classically ought to be a immovable barrier, but essentially can manifest on the other side. And that's a very poor description, but some very clever people have essentially proven that and won the Nobel Physics Prize last year. There's a lot of quantum chatter in the market, and it's a good time to, I think, lean in. You know, I was really keen to have this conversation, try and understand a bit more. And to do that, I feel like we should start with what is quantum computing, and then we can perhaps get on to what that means for the world of crypto. So I don't know whether you're up for taking a stab at that, if you can perhaps describe in sort of lay terms really what quantum computing is, Chris.
Yeah, sure. Happy to. And I think that's a great place to start. And I think, you know, also important is to understand, you know, I guess my background and my biases that I bring to this research problem, right? So, I, you know, I am not a mathematician or a physicist or even an engineer, right? You know, I am I'm a generalist and I'm an investor. And so it's that perspective, you know, I'm trying to understand risk and how it pertains to certain kind of opportunities that we might invest in. This risk that's presented itself on the horizon here, this risk of quantum computing and its potential to, you know, break Bitcoin or other digital assets or cryptographic networks in general, it seems like it could be an existential risk, you know, for our asset class, for our industry. And so it's up to, you know, the prudent investor really to kind of dig in and understand it. You know, but being a generalist, you know, we look at lots of different types of risks. And, you know, it's all about trying to figure out how to make sense of that risk, box it, and determine, are we getting enough reward or compensation for the risk that we're taking in any given investment? And part of that diligence process is reaching out to the real experts, you know, literally people who have been studying quantum for over 10 years and, you know, deep kind of, you know, mathematicians, physicists. You know, there's the whole hardware side of the problem. There's software. As you mentioned, you know, people have been studying this field for decades, right? And it does get complicated quickly. My co-author on the paper, Priti, you know, she's a PhD cryptographer, you know, and she's on staff. And as I mentioned, you know, we have other real kind of, you know, experts. But me and my role as director of digital asset research and a portfolio manager at the firm, you know, it's kind of my job to find the experts, talk to them, and kind of translate what they're saying into a way that makes sense for our investment process and for our customers, right, who are coming to us saying, you know, hey, you know, the potential returns in this asset class look interesting, but I am concerned about the risks. You know, walk me through smart contract risk, walk me through, you know, execution risk. And now they're saying, walk me through the quantum risk. And so to your point, it really does start with kind of understanding, you know, quantum mechanics and quantum computing, and how is this different from regular computing? And so the way I've kind of wrapped my head around it is that in classical computing, we're dealing with bits, we're dealing with zeros and ones, you know, kind of these binary outcomes. And when we get to quantum computing, it does get a little tricky and nuanced, right? Like, I think one of the best analogies I heard was, you know, if you're flipping a coin, instead of, you know, heads or tails, and again, that's the zeros and ones in classical computing, it's as if the coin was spinning, right? And so it has some kind of, you know, distribution or probability, depending on how it's spinning and the angle of being heads and tails. It has the potential to be either, right? It can't end up being both at the end of the day, but while it's spinning, there's this potential for heads and tails rather than something binary, a zero or a one. And I think that mental model starts to kind of just scratch the surface a little bit in terms of quantum mechanics as it applies to quantum computing. So quantum computing, we're talking about these really kind of advanced, and as you mentioned, large computers where we're either attempting, you know, really, 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 really cold temperatures, or we're trapping atoms. There's different ways to do it, but it is very complicated. And we have these baseline quantum computers now. But what we're interested from the digital asset side is at what point will we have cryptographically relevant quantum computers that can say, you know, use Shor's algorithm, which is something that was developed in the 1990s. But the computing power hasn't been there, but use an algorithm like that to actually create a real tangible threat for Bitcoin, digital assets, and the cryptography that really underpins this whole asset class. So that's kind of some initial framing, and happy to take it wherever you want.
Yeah, I'll see if I can add to that. We haven't got Professor Brian Cox here to explain this in elegant terms, but from what I picked up, you know, quantum folks talk in terms of qubits, and classic computing is ones and zeros. And to your point, that analogy of the spinning coin is probably the best description I've heard in the last few days, that there's this concept of superposition so that these quantum particles can exist in either the zero state or the one state, well, actually both at the same time. And as a result, when you start adding qubits to your quantum computer, you're able to store values simultaneously, and the power of the computer scales exponentially with the number of qubits that you put on. And so unlike a classic computer that's just got a long string of ones and zeros that can generate one number, the quantum computer can store all those values at the same time. And the theory goes that by the time we get to 300 qubits, you've got more data points, more values that you can store than there are particles in the observable universe. And hence, doing really complicated maths, like working out the private key, if you've got the public key, in an encryption algorithm, you can actually do that by this sort of insane recursive maths of working out the prime numbers that have gone into the private key. So the implication being that all of this cryptography that's locking down the bitcoins and the ethers of the world at some point in the medium term future may simply be crackable in, you know, not in a million years, but in a matter of minutes and seconds by these quantum computers. So yeah. That was my read on it.
Definitely. And you're really touching on, I think, a very important point. Like, what actually is the risk to Bitcoin and digital assets from quantum computing? And, you know, there was initial concerns. Does it have to do with Bitcoin mining? Does it have to do with the hash rate? And really, when you kind of dive into it, you realize that the primary risk is that a quantum attacker could, say, use this algorithm, Shor's algorithm, to back into or reverse engineer someone's private key from an exposed, you know, public key. By using quantum computing, the whole idea of this cryptography is it's really easy to go one direction, you know, to generate that private key, generate that public key, but it's very hard to go backwards, right? And quantum computing is what kind of makes that possible. And so the real risk here is that, yes, a quantum attacker could forge signatures. So it doesn't break Bitcoin, or it doesn't break these blockchains. What it does is it allows someone to forge signatures, which would allow to the potential to steal funds or do transactions that are unauthorized. But what's interesting is even in that example, the blockchain would still be running as expected, right? Again, you're just forging transactions. You're not hacking or breaking the chain. So that's kind of interesting when you think through the risk vectors with this technology. And I think you brought up another great point too, is this idea of qubits or quantum bits. It's when I first kind of tackled this problem and we looked at it, it looked like, okay, we're at maybe 100 now. And when you get to 1,000 of these qubits, you know, or whatever it is, at some point you cross the threshold of being able to kind of break these cryptographic signatures. And I think the key thing that we've picked up, the nuance here, is that it's not just scaling the raw number of physical qubits, right? It's about bringing the error correction, the error down, making it fault tolerant. That's just as important. So it's the quality, not just the quantity, that you need to actually, you know, kind of create an attack here. So I think that's really important. So when we've seen advancements in chips, like the new kind of Google Willow chip or that recently came out, that was less qubits. It was only 105 qubits, but it's kind of a step function improvement in quality and error correction than we saw from, say, the IBM chip, which was actually more qubits, 127. And so, you know, it's not just scaling the raw number of physical qubits, but this idea of logical qubits, of quality, of error correction that really makes it, you know, a little tricky to kind of nail down the time frame, right? Because if you improve the quality, you need less of the actual qubits, and we might be getting to that Q day a little sooner than we thought.
Yeah, and this comes to that point about the machines. So again, sort of dipping into sort of the bit of the physics that I clearly don't fully understand, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. The super-cooled machines are trying to keep these atomic particles in, subatomic particles in a quantum state at temperatures colder than space, and that's why all the pipes and machinery, and there's an error rate. There's a whole thing around when you try and measure it, you actually get a binary output instead of the superposed state prior. So I won't go there, but the outcome, I think, from the research, and it's been going on over years and decades, is that there is quite a significant error rate, and it's not just about how many sort of qubit modules you sort of bolt on, how many particles you're bolting onto the machine. It's actually to what extent you can rely on the computations and the accuracy of the output. I mean, that Willow, the Google Willow experiment, that sort of jumped out from the research I was doing. And there's a whole load of conspiracy theories out there that Google have shut it down because they found something, they cracked something that should never be cracked, and they've solved some unsolvable problems that have got a massive risk attached to them. I don't know whether you picked up on that.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's such a super fascinating area. And I think because it's kind of multidimensional, this problem, that's what makes it tricky to, you know, a lot of the industry right now is, well, is this a problem this year? Is it a problem by 2030? You know, I mean, some people are like, you know, this is 20 years out, right? And the reason why it's tricky to nail this down is because of kind of what you allude to, right? There's different ways to make advancements. We're starting to see, you know, advancements. We've seen also pretty prominent, you know, figures in the industry, whether it's, you know, Vitalik from Ethereum or actual quantum researchers, change their view, their estimate of when we'll have a cryptographically relevant quantum computer. I mean, some of these people were experts originally saying, you know, this is 10 years out, and now they're saying it could be within 5. You know. And I think the problem with nailing that down relates to how kind of multifaceted this whole issue is.
Yeah. And the research has been going on for a long time. When you look into it, you can find videos on YouTube that are over a decade old on this, and then a whole lot more recently. So let's talk a bit more about institutional impact and risk. So you didn't just come on the show to geek out on the physics with someone who doesn't really know how it works. Before we jump right into today's episode, a quick thank you to our sponsor, NextWave. NextWave is an award-winning consultancy that is helping many of the world's leading banks, investment managers, and insurers deliver on their growth, efficiency, risk, and control goals and transform their businesses. With a senior team who have come from MD-level positions in major firms like HSBC, Barclays, and UBS, NextWave has both the deep industry expertise and the hands-on capabilities in AI, data, and automation to drive real results. More business outcomes and less PowerPoint from the consulting experience, as their clients like to say. NextWave has moved 2-week manual processes to 5-minute agentic automations, rescued global banking regulatory control programs, and digitized deal platforms, sustainability, and regulatory reporting systems. And they do much of this with hands-on engineering capabilities on leading technologies, which include ServiceNow, Alteryx, Quantexa, and Komunda. So if a modern and specialist alternative to the big brand consulting model sounds appealing, one which covers the full life cycle of strategy specialists and solutions, but with small practitioner teams, rapid delivery, and a better price point, then perhaps you should talk to NextWave. Visit nxwave.com to find out more and get in touch. That's nxwave.com. All right, let's get back to the episode. So let's move this forward. We talked about the potential for cracking encryption, for deriving private keys that are used on blockchain protocols, and the very real risk of that. So perhaps that's a place to start. But Chris, can you talk a bit about, you know, what are the risk vectors for institutions and indeed for individuals in a post-quantum world when this capability is real?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's an interesting thought experiment to kind of put yourself almost in the role of a quantum attacker. You know, I guess first and foremost, you know, one of our conclusions is that this problem has gone from a research problem to an engineering problem. So it's really gone from a question of, you know, when, not if, in our mind. So at some point, we will have a cryptographically relevant quantum computer. And, you know, the way it stands right now is there is a honeypot that exists on the Bitcoin network that an attacker will likely try to go after, right? Because it's almost like a bounty, you know, to whoever kind of can crack it first will be rewarded with this honeypot. And to underscore what that is, it's really these older keys. So the kind of Satoshi era Bitcoin in these older wallets. Those public keys are known, they've been exposed. So a potential quantum attacker, right, has these public keys, has known about them, has time to kind of reverse engineer using an algorithm like Shor's and one of these quantum computers to kind of reverse engineer that private key and authorize a transaction to kind of steal those funds, right? So that seems to be one of the kind of lower hanging fruits or bounties that an attacker might go off after. I think in the paper, and as we thought about it, we actually think there'll be an attack probably more likely at some of the areas where the on-chain world meets the off-chain world. When we think about in the past, when keys are compromised and funds are stolen, it's usually happening at like an exchange or some other kind of multi-sig or you know, something like that, right? And usually a lot of times it's a phishing scam or, you know, someone's computer was compromised, but somehow private keys were compromised and funds were stolen. And, you know, we kind of chalked that up to, oh, well, that was a second or third tier exchange and their OPSEC wasn't as good. So, because I think the problem is if an attacker goes and steals Satoshi's coins, that sets off all the alarms, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, putting yourself in the shoe or the role of the attacker, they'd probably want it to go undetected for as long as possible. So we think they'd probably try to compromise, you know, an exchange or a custodian or something like that first. But you know, I think the Satoshi era coins are probably the next most logical area that they'd go after. So again, when we're defining the risk and thinking through it, it's kind of identifying where the highest probability attack, you know, vectors are, and then kind of the downstream ramifications. If we see Satoshi's key, you know, Bitcoin move, you know, people are going to quickly jump to, oh my gosh, was that a quantum attacker, or did Satoshi just wake up and move, you know, his Bitcoin? At any point, it's going to create issues of trust in the network, right? And you could imagine, you know, a sell-off and kind of a race for the door. So I think the ramifications of this are pretty material, right? Like, if all of a sudden, we as an industry wake up one day and realize, you know, someone has figured out how to forge signatures, and it's certainly this earlier era Bitcoin, which there's quite a bit of it, is exposed. It does create, you know, can we really trust this Bitcoin, the store of value, given with this kind of new attack vector that's no longer theoretical, but actually here and now.
Yeah, and I think in the report, you call out various protocols. What is it about those early coins and protocols that make them more risky? Is it, as you know, shorter number sequences, different algorithms? I mean, is this something? And how much of the sort of coin universe does that cover?
Yeah, so what makes them most vulnerable is that the full public key address is known. So it's not just a hash of that. So I think in later kind of scripts and signatures, the public key is hashed. And so you don't actually get to see it and know it. But just to give some context numbers, you know, 0.3% of the UTXOs is this unspent, these Bitcoin addresses, they account for about 8.7% of Bitcoin's total value. So it's, it, again, it's a kind of a small, you know, a, attack vector, but that leads to a lot of value. So, yeah, I mean, that would be, you know, certainly an area that would be a target, you know, initially. I think in kind of newer, you know, Bitcoin addresses, again, you have that hash that's protecting you a little bit. But there are, again, other signatures where the public key is exposed during the time of a Bitcoin block. So you have like, you know, 6 minutes of exposure that an attacker could take that public key, reverse engineer the private key. But 6 minutes is a lot shorter than, again, the Satoshi era ones, which have been known for years, right? And they could spend the time to actually work to reverse engineer.
And I guess when Bitcoin started, we're talking 2009, around about then. Yeah. And I don't know whether folks were even thinking about quantum risk at that point.
Yeah. So interestingly, I think, you know, Satoshi actually, you know, kind of was aware of, you know, quantum, and there are kind of early, you know, kind of correspondence thoughts around this. So, you know, it was known and aware, you know, even back then, but.
Yeah. And you mentioned a 6 minute window there, I think, on the more modern protocols. What's the, can you tell us a bit more? What's that?
Yeah. So, basically when you transact, you know, during the time of a new block being added to the Bitcoin blockchain, it's about, you know, kind of, you know, 6 minutes that the block has been assembled and appended to the chain. And during that, the time of that short window, the public key gets exposed. And so you do have a little bit of kind of a window and a kind of a risk vector there because it is shown during that block.
Okay. So you've got, I think you call it differential impact on different privacy protocols, all pertaining to, you know, in this example, Bitcoin we were talking about. But where are the other impact areas from your research, and not just perhaps on Bitcoin?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the next kind of step you might go with your thinking is this just a Bitcoin problem? Is this relate to other blockchains as well? And with other, you know, kind of let, you know, your Ethereum and Solanas of the world, there you actually, the public key is used, you know, more often, right? So in a way, you have more exposure there. Plus, because of the whole idea of money Legos and the composability of blockchain and these primitives, if you fix it in one place, you know, again, it's all connected. So I think it's a messier problem with these smart contract blockchains. On the positive side, those chains have shown more ability to upgrade themselves. And in these decentralized networks, part of the problem is a social coordination problem, right? You almost, you know, herd the cats, so to speak, to get a large improvement agreed upon, passed, implemented. And so it's one of the criticisms we hear out there is, well, you know, look, if quantum computing becomes a risk, someone can, you know, hack or, you know, kind of break into these wallets on Bitcoin, you know, they're doing that with nuclear launch codes, and they're doing that with our banks and the whole world, right? It's going to be a problem way outside of crypto. The problem with that argument, though, is outside of these decentralized networks, you have people running businesses or governments or whatnot, you know, you can upgrade a lot faster. So I think it is harder for these decentralized networks to agree on the upgrade path and to actually implement it. And so that's what makes it kind of trickier in the blockchain space. So, but we do see networks like in ecosystems like Ethereum or Solana being able to kind of implement, you know, these upgrade paths. I think recently we just heard the Ethereum Foundation is going to launch, you know, kind of a crypto task force to kind of look into this, make recommendations. And so, you know, we as investors, we like to see that, right? We want, you know, teams and communities to kind of take this seriously. We don't think that the problem is one of necessarily tomorrow. You know, we do kind of put it in more of that 5 to 8 years out, but we want to see teams not dismissive of this and actually working towards a solution.
Yeah, it's a good lead into what should be the response and readiness. I think you talk about this a lot in your paper. And as I understand it, the industry in some sectors has been thinking ahead and really preparing for post-quantum era for some time. There have been some competitions running, I think, 7 years or so out there on, you know, what are the privacy techniques that we're going to need. But if you could perhaps talk a bit about what, you know, what form response and readiness is taking. You mentioned upgrades, but you know, what can you do about this?
Yeah, I mean, so on the good news is is that there are actually some ideas of kind of post-quantum or quantum resistant signatures that we could kind of upgrade, you know, these wallets to. The bad news or the downside is the ones that have the most, that are the most tried and true, kind of battle tested, are considerably, you know, larger in size. And so when we think about the performance of these chains, not all chains are high throughput. And so if we're taking, the signatures and we're upgrading to something that, you know, is a lot more kind of resource intensive, it might really slow down the performance of these chains. There are a variety of potential kind of quantum resistant or post-quantum solutions on the signature side. As some of them, you know, are more performant, but the trade-off there is they're less battle tested. There's less agreement or consensus around them. And I think this just gets into a broader issue of there's no clear-cut path. So there's lots of potentially good ideas, and there's different camps, right, that are kind of promoting these different ideas. And so there isn't consensus currently, and you need consensus to eventually kind of upgrade. And then once you achieve consensus and you're like, okay, this is the upgrade path, then you have to actually implement it. And that also takes a long time, again, just due to the throughput of some of these chains like Bitcoin, right? And so, I think some estimates are if you use, you know, kind of 25% of each block that gets, you know, appended to the blockchain just for migration, you know, it's still going to take, and the other 75% for normal transactions, it's still going to take a really long time. And then what do you do about the accounts that are lost? You know, it's Satoshi's coins, you know, how are you going to upgrade those? And so then there's also a divide in terms of the community thinking around, well, do we freeze them? Do we burn them? Like, what do you do with them? And so as we think about the various types of risks or problems, I think there's the technical issues, but then there's the social coordination issues. And those are almost trickier to figure out, you know, than just the technical ones. Because again, we do have kind of ideas for post-quantum and quantum resistant, you know, signatures, right? But it's how do you get the community to agree to upgrade, and what do you do about the people who can't upgrade? That's, I think, the trickier problem.
And you've got a variety of stakeholders. So you've got the standards institutes, you've got organizations like the NSA, and you have big tech, you have custodians. So are there any initiatives that really stand out to you that, you know, you, Franklin, are backing and saying, well, this is how we're going to bring that community together and solve these issues for the industry?
We don't have a view in terms of which one is best. I think there's, several that sound interesting. And also, right, we have an early stage kind of blockchain venture group that, is certainly kind of interested in this space too, right? Because we think this could not only be defensive, but, you know, and people are, especially in calls like this, we're talking about the risks of quantum to digital assets and blockchains, but there's certainly opportunities as well that come from unlocking this technology. So, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting advancements being made, and some of those actually we think are interesting opportunities on the venture side. But in terms of which one is best, like that we would advocate the community to migrate towards, we don't have a preference. We just, our big thing is we want to see communities at least, you know, discussing these issues and making progress towards them rather than just, you know, kind of dismissing them. So that's kind of our big takeaway.
And you mentioned some of the initiatives may well turn out to be opportunities, as well as obviously mitigating the downside risks. So what's the investment implications of post-quantum era then? And sort of where do you see that presenting opportunities, or perhaps what should investors be thinking about post-quantum?
Yeah, so, and this gets into a little bit of how we started the call, right? I mean, I do think there, you know, this whole uncertainty, you know, markets like clarity. So the uncertainty associated with this risk has created some, you know, overhang, I think, on, you know, Bitcoin's price. And so, you know, one opportunity is markets are forward looking, right? You don't actually need to, you know, solve this problem outright, but you need, you know, once we start to see, kind of consensus start to formulate around an upgrade path, I think a lot of that overhang uncertainty gets lifted, and it does help, you know, Bitcoin and other kind of digital asset prices. And then, you know, there are actual providers that might be coming up with solutions that can be implemented. And, you know, some of this stuff might be just public good, but it, but some of them, you know, if it's a commercial application, you know, there could be an actual opportunity for you know, a company there to sell something or actually capture some of that value created from a solution here as well. So I think there are, it is probably some interesting investments on the quantum side, but really the big one is, I think if you can start to remove a little bit of this overhang by, again, kind of just getting some of the clarity around an upgrade path and consensus around that, that right there just, you know, helps a bunch.
Yeah, it's an interesting, that's why I think this is so topical. It's an interesting conversation at this point in time. Blockchain technologies are being so whole scale adopted and now by major institutions. So everyone's going all in on stable coins and tokenized money market funds and the rest. Are you worried about the quantum risk, you know, against that backdrop?
I think having some of these larger players involved, you know, whether it's the large asset managers like ourselves and our peers who are offering some of these exchange traded products, you know, in the crypto space, or it's the digital asset treasury companies who are, you know, very big players in terms of, you know, kind of buying, holding Bitcoin and other assets. I think that's helpful, you know, because you have kind of more voices, more at stake. And in addition to the crypto native community and really the key developers there, I think that's a good thing, a good part of the evolving kind of market structure to have some of these institutional players involved. We want to be part of, you know, the conversation, and I think our peers are the same way. There is a lot at stake here to figure this out. And I think when incentives are properly aligned like that, it does increase your chances of getting towards constructive solutions.
Yeah. I mean, do you think there'll be a post-quantum premium for certain assets and custodians that are on the front foot? I mean, I guess it's a bit like we all want a bank with the bank that's been shown to be most cyber resilient. I mean, this is really a direct parallel, I guess.
Yeah, 100%. So as we look at and kind of underwrite new opportunities in this space, you know, it's definitely become part of our risk framework and diligence process. And so, you know, whether it's discounting a project that is dismissive of these risks more heavily, or to the flip side of that is, as you point out, you know, almost like attaching, you know, kind of a risk premium to companies or teams that are very forward thinking about this, or due to the nature of the cryptographic primitives that they're implementing in their chain or product, if it is more quantum resistant, you know, absolutely. I think you can, you know, attach a little bit of a premium as you think about valuation of those projects. So it's 100% being incorporated both into how we value things, but also into our diligence process and the questions that we ask as we kind of meet with these teams and founders.
Yeah, and the sort of industry upgrade feels to me a little bit like solving the Y2K problem, and that there needs to be a concerted effort to develop the solution ahead of the threat. And I was reading about something called Harvest Now, Decrypt Later, HNDL, where certain organizations apparently are harvesting all of these public keys and all this data now on the basis that the technology will arrive soonest to decrypt them.
Yeah, for sure. And because that's already happening now, that does make it a higher priority, right? And that's where, like, you know, NIST has come up with standards already. And I think that impacts, you know, not just blockchain and crypto, right? But any encrypted web traffic is at risk, you know, crypto or otherwise, right? So I think, you know, implementing some of those standards, you know, sooner rather than later, there's more a sense of urgency there now, because to your point, even though we don't have the ability, you know, as an industry kind of crack that encrypted web traffic, you know, data right now, you know, people are harvesting it so that they could attempt to kind of break it later.
Yeah, so what sort of timeline do you think we're on?
You know, again, we're kind of in that, you know, 5 to 8 year range, you know, which I would say is middle of the pack. You certainly see a lot of, you know, kind of more alarmists thinking that, you know, this is really happening by 2030. And then you see people who are, you know, hey, this is 15, you know, plus years out. I feel like, you know, we're kind of in that being 5 to 8, we're kind of in the middle of that, those two kind of camps.
Maybe a mute point. We'll all be run by artificial general intelligence and robots by then. So I might have something else to worry about.
Yeah. I mean, I think, AI and agents both can help and advance the research probably more quickly. Both, the cryptographically relevant quantum computer probably is born or, this idea of Q-Day happens earlier because of AI. The flip side of that is coming up with quantum resistant, technologies and solutions. We can probably develop those faster with AI as well. As I mentioned, there's a variety of signatures that are being contemplated, the ability to kind of test and build those various solutions. I think we could use, as an industry, AI to help with that as well.
So it's kind of a sort of perfect storm of technology powered innovation and analytics. It's going to be fascinating to see that flywheel effect and see how AI sort of fits with quantum progress and what we can do. Because we've been talking about finance, but there's plenty of other things out there. So DNA research and medicine and space travel and many other topics, which where folks are getting even more excited about the potential of the quantum era. So looking forward then, and we sort of started to touch on it, but any predictions for quantum milestones this year? Given that we were talking about the accelerating pace of progress in the sector, and we've still got a bit of a timeline ahead of us, but are there any particular milestones that you think might drop this year that are going to make everyone sit up and pay attention?
Yeah, I think it's a safe bet that there'll be something. I don't know what it is. I'd be curious if there's a prediction market. Actually, there are prediction markets set up already in terms of, will there be a quantum, attack by this date? But in terms of what's the next advancement or milestone, we'll see. I don't know what it'll be, but I'm sure we'll see something this year. Because again, it is a field that is moving, quickly.
That's an interesting point. I'll have to look at the prediction market. That's a topic that's been coming up more and more often. You forget, or I forget, that there are now platforms out there where you can take a position on almost anything. And
yeah.
When's there going to be a quantum attack? Right. Okay.
And we've heard some people using that.
Numbers
are
on that.
Right. They'll own a bunch of Bitcoin and then maybe they'll, take out a bet on a protection market or invest in some quantum companies. It's almost like a hedge to their Bitcoin.
Yeah. Now, those who've made big Bitcoin bets, maybe digital asset treasuries and the rest, so some of them I think are going to be finding life a little bit difficult at the moment anyway, even without the quantum risk. So what's next for Franklin in this space? So, when I was thinking, hey, I'd love to talk to someone about quantum, I thought of you guys almost straight away because I knew how much you were doing in the crypto space and you seem to be on the front edge of so many sector topics. What are you doing in your business to prepare for the quantum era?
Yeah, I mean, I think one is to stay kind of sharp and up to date on it, right? So as mentioned, just within our firm, we do have kind of really legit, quantum experts. And then, obviously in our external network, even more. So, we've done our initial kind of, deep dive into this topic and this risk. And the paper was a result of that. And changing, our diligence frameworks and our risk frameworks, this is now a part of it. As I mentioned, we're very much, applying what we've been learning into our investment process. And I think that's one of the takeaways, for your audience and other people who are investing or interested in this space of digital assets is, you just have to be, you want to be aware of all the risks. This is just another, kind of risk. But there's, again, opportunities from it as well. So just trying to kind of think through it. So I think the key is to stay on top of it. And then, in terms of, the opportunity side, I think that is where it's interesting on the venture capital side. There are some, publicly traded, companies involved in this space that are kind of interesting. And potentially worth following as well. I think important to stay on top of it for defensive purposes, for risk mitigation, but then also opportunistically for companies or solutions developing in this space where it's an interesting investment opportunity.
Yeah, and where would you point the audience if they want to find out more about quantum computing, what's coming, and more particularly the risk and potentially opportunity side of it that you were talking about? Obviously, we'll list the paper that you wrote in the show notes, but any good sources that you recommend on all of this?
There's a lot. The Venn diagram of actually kind of crypto people and quantum, there's actually not a whole lot of overlap, so you can get really good kind of quantum insights, but it won't necessarily pertain to crypto and kind of vice versa. But, one of our, kind of friends of the industry, Nick Carter out there, I think he's done a great job, because he actually, he really understands crypto and he's really kind of deep dived into on the quantum side of things. So he's written a series of blog posts. He even wrote a short fiction story kind of based on this. But it's very digestible, by the layperson. I think he's another great resource that's kind of in the middle of this diagram or Venn diagram of quantum and crypto. And then if you really want to nerd out, you can go more into the quantum side. I was just watching interviews with these physicists trying to trap atoms with lasers. I mean, it really does get crazy. So there's a lot that you can really nerd out in on the kind of pure science side too.
Yeah, that's the wormhole I went down when I started looking at this. I didn't find really much talking about quantum risk to your crypto investments, but I found a lot about how qubits work and spin up, spin down, and the very weird world of quantum mechanics. And if you for those with that sort of slightly warped curiosity, which I guess I have a little bit of, it is fascinating.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and on a more personal level, what are you reading, listening to currently? Anything interesting?
I try to take in as much as I can from multiple types of sources. I think we're at such an interesting point in this industry's trajectory, right? Where you really do see like DeFi and the on-chain world really converging with the traditional world. And so that creates a lot of interesting kind of opportunity. And being at a global asset manager, right? So we sit really at that nexus. It's exciting times. I think when there is kind of short-term volatility and noise, it's healthy to kind of zoom back and again, look at the longer-term trajectory that we're on and really the secular tailwind here. And that's what gets me, keeps me excited.
Yeah. And if folks want to know more about you or what Franklin's doing, presumably Franklin website, and I guess you're living on LinkedIn these days like the rest of us.
Yeah. Our website and also our X handle. We have kind of a digital asset focused X handle where we put out a lot of our research and whatnot. That's another good place.
Okay. Well, and if we can share that in the show notes as well. So lots of places to go and find out more. At this point, Chris, we're going to run out of time, but thank you. Thank you for coming on the show. We've explained a few things. I think we've probably posed a few more questions at the same time, but this is right on the sharp end of innovation in the industry, and as I said, a sort of a fascinating topic from a sort of physics perspective as well as a what's going to happen to my finances perspective, and something I'm going to keep a close eye on.
Yep. Thanks, Tony. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.